This is local and regional news from KMUN. I'm Skylar Butenchin. It's Thursday, February 5th. Oregon lawmakers saw a slightly brighter budget picture on Wednesday, but as Dirk Vanderhart reports, spending cuts still loom in the ongoing legislative session.
The legislature gaveled in on Monday under an assumption it would need to find about $750 million for the state's general fund. Now lawmakers have a bit more breathing room. The latest revenue forecast predicts the state will bring in about $100 million more than previously expected. Corporate taxes are coming in stronger than anticipated, despite expected reductions in personal income taxes brought on by rising unemployment. The new forecast doesn't shield lawmakers from tough choices. On Tuesday, the legislature heard hours of testimony from Oregonians advocating against cuts to a huge variety of programs. Democrats are also pushing a bill that would sever the state's tax code from some federal tax cuts passed last year. That would bring hundreds of millions of dollars more into state coffers. But opponents argue it amounts to a tax hike. I'm Dirk Vanderhart reporting.
The Florence City Council voted 3-2 on Monday to continue its contract with automatic license plate camera company Flock Safety. KLCC's Rebecca Hansen-White reports.
Many community members oppose the cameras, saying they violate their privacy and could be abused by the federal government. Florence Police Chief John Pitcher said he restricted access to the city system to only Oregon's agencies, added a transparency portal, and required officers to provide specific justification for their searches.
We welcome the community holding the Florence Police Department accountable. We welcome that. We want that. And they should.
Florence now has 6 Flock cameras, which take searchable photos of vehicles and stores them for 30 days. Eugene and Springfield both ended their contracts with Flock late last year. I'm Rebecca Hansen-White reporting.
The high school graduating class of 2025 was the first group of students to complete 4 consecutive years of in-person school following the disruption caused by the pandemic. Across Clatsop County, school districts saw strong graduation rates. The Astoria School District posted a 95% 2025 graduation rate. Superintendent Craig Hoppus says the rate has steadily increased in recent years, which he attributes in part to improved student engagement and consistent in-person instruction. The Warrenton-Hammond School District's graduation rate was at 76%, a slight decrease from the prior year. The Jewell School District graduation rate for the 4-year cohort was 100%. Napa High School's 4-year graduation rate for the class of 2025 was 73%. Superintendent Bill Fritz says because of Napa's small size, the district is focused on building strong relationships with students, an approach he says helps address the many barriers to graduation. And the Seaside School District's graduation rate for the class of 2025 was 78%. Seaside Superintendent Susan Penrod says chronic absenteeism is an issue statewide, and Seaside is working through a solution to solve it. Penrod says one factor that is causing absenteeism is fear from some families about the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. Across Oregon, the high school class of 2025 graduated at a statewide rate of 83%. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. A heated debate over a state income tax has begun in Washington's legislature. Democrats call it a millionaire's tax and will hold their first hearings on the bill tomorrow. KUOW's Scott Greenstone has more.
An income tax on the richest Washington households would start at $1 million. Every dollar over that would be taxed a little less than a dime. Democrats want to use that revenue for tax relief for small businesses and families that make mid-5 figures. State Senator Monka Dhingra.
We have to do something that can fix our tax code moving forward, because there's a quality of life that people in the state of Washington want and demand.
Republicans called the tax proposal illegal and, quote, against the people's voice. Voters and the state Supreme Court have knocked down income taxes in the past. Some business groups and Governor Bob Ferguson, a Democrat, say the proposal is not where it needs to be, but it's a start. I'm Scott Greenstone in Olympia.
A hydro project that could store enough energy to power most homes in Seattle just got the go-ahead from the federal government. Developers say it will help the Northwest meet its carbon-free energy goals. NWPB's senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt has this update.
The Goldendale Energy Storage Project would be the largest facility of its kind in the Northwest. It'd be built in South Central Washington. To store energy, water would be pumped between two reservoirs. When wind and solar energy aren't available to the grid, this new source would fill the gap. Developer Eric Steinle says this project is a big milestone for the region.
A storage project like this that's sustainable over a long period of time essentially becomes the backbone of the renewable energy grid.
Federal licensing sets the stage for construction to begin on the project within the next 2 to 3 years. Still, there is pushback from local tribes, including the Yakama Nation, who may appeal the approval. They say the project will destroy invaluable sacred sites. I'm Courtney Flatt.
The Pacific Northwest's winter snowpack is in some of its worst shape ever. Snow levels in Washington state are barely half of normal. In Oregon, they're less than a third of normal. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
Washington's snowpack is at its third lowest level on record for early February. The key resource for salmon, irrigation, and hydropower has taken a hit following the warmest December in more than a century of record-keeping. Winter is far enough along by now that scientists say it would take a miracle amount of snow to dig the state out of its low snow rut. Many ski areas are on reduced operations, while farmers are worried about the impacts this summer. Without much snow in the mountains to melt slowly over the summer, water supplies for crops like apples and cherries would be reduced. The Yakima Basin is now in its third year in a row of snow drought. Most of the important agricultural basin's water supplies come from melting mountain snow. I'm John Ryan reporting.
Brown's Camp OHV Campground in Tillamook State Forest lands will transition from a first-come, first-served model to a reservation-only system when it reopens for the season on April 1st. Recreation Facilities Manager Ben Burns with the Oregon Department of Forestry says the new system at Brown's Camp will eliminate frustrations for campers and also improve operational efficiencies. Brown's Camp has 28 campsites, and ODF encourages visitors to reserve early. The group camping area at Brown's Camp is already reservation-based and will remain unchanged. Campsites can be reserved at reserveamerica.com. This is KMUN. Up next is a piece from Minnesota Native News on how tribes and the state's indigenous community are responding to the increased federal presence in the Twin Cities. After that, the American Democracy Minute. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Murray Rock. This week, how tribes and the state's indigenous community are responding to the increased federal presence, and a youth hockey night series is uplifting the Ojibwe language. First, Zan Holston reports on how tribal leaders are issuing IDs in response to federal operations in the Twin Cities.
We've had some of our people picked up by ICE, held in custody, which makes no sense because we are Native American. We've been here longer than any of them.
Brian Joyce is program director for the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act at the Minneapolis American Indian Center. He said as Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, actions over the past weeks have snared Native Americans, multiple tribal nations have set up stations at the Indian Center.
We've had now six tribes down here giving out new IDs.
That includes White Earth, Lakota Ray, and a number of Lakota and Dakota tribes from South Dakota. Others, like Red Lake, Leech Lake, have offered services through their urban offices or at Powwow Grounds Coffee Shop just down the block from the Indian Center. Tribal ID cards can help prevent wrongful detention, especially for people without state-issued IDs or those who are unhoused.
but we'll get some volunteers to do things like take pictures of people, get their information, send it to the tribes, and they'll sell cards back down here.
Community members are encouraged to check their tribe's websites and social media pages for upcoming ID clinics. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Zan Holston.
Deanna Standing Cloud looks at how community members are organizing acts of resilience.
A young Native man sprinkles a pinch of tobacco into the dancing flames of a spirit fire in the inner city of Minneapolis. Dozens of community members gather as an act of resilience in the wake of federal Operation Metro Surge.
We learn from our elders, our old ones, like the founders of the American Movement in 1968, that we come together in time of need.
Crow Belcourt is of the Bad River Chippewa Tribe and the executive director of the Indigenous Protector Movement, who has partnered with All My Relations Arts, Powwow Grounds, and the Native American Community Development Institute, or NACDI, to stage a hub for community members and trained observers on the streets of Minneapolis.
We have cars pulling up by the truckloads, dropping off supplies, food, diapers, wood.
Angel Swan is a citizen of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and operations director of NACDI.
When you get onto this property, the energy shifts, and it's not so scary anymore when you're with a group of people, and you need the laughter through this really hard time.
The Indigenous Protector Movement is still accepting food, snacks, firewood, and non-perishable goods at 1414 East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Deanna Standing Cloud.
In our final story, Jazz Wagner brings us to Heritage Hockey Night, where families celebrate culture, language, and community.
The scent of sage and the sounds of drumming filled the cold air in Virginia on January 20th as the puck dropped between the Rock Ridge Wolverines and the Cloquet Lumberjacks. Gordon Majiganeash Jourdain leans into the microphone to deliver an exciting play-by-play in Anishinaabe Mohan.
Hockey is an action-oriented game, and Ojibwe lends itself as a perfect language to describe what they're doing because it's an action-oriented language.
Gordon Jourdain is a first language Ojibwe speaker and announced a Minnesota Wild game, the first game ever broadcast in Ojibwe language. Maria Potterze is the Indigenous Director for the Rock Ridge Public Schools. She organized the special two-night Native American Heritage Hockey Nights. The first of two nights featured a girls' hockey exhibition game. The game was broadcast live in Ojibwe Mohan on KBFT Boys Fort Tribal Radio, Misabi Community TV, and streamed online at the Rock Ridge YouTube channel.
We do have another event coming, and that is the boys varsity hockey game. And we predict that that event is going to be packed because that is our biggest rival.
That game will take place on January 30th at the Iron Trail Motors Arena and will also be broadcast in Ojibwe. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Chaz Wagner.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have updates on two important U.S. Supreme Court cases we've been following. Submitted briefs are complete in the GOP emergency challenge to California's midterm congressional redistricting, and a March date has been set for oral arguments in Mississippi's mail ballot deadline case. The California State GOP made an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court to block mid-decade redistricting maps drawn as a response to GOP gerrymandering of five congressional seats in Texas. While a lower court found the Texas maps to be obvious racial gerrymanders, the U.S. Supreme Court found them to be partisan gerrymandered and allowed them to stand. In California, a district court found the Proposition 50 map to be partisan, not a racial gerrymander. But it's unclear whether the high court's majority will allow it to stand or play politics and block it. A decision is expected shortly. In Mississippi, an appeal in Watson v. Republican National Committee hopes to overturn a Fifth Circuit panel's opinion striking down the state's five-day grace period for mail-in ballots and requiring they be received by Election Day. The U.S. Supreme Court has now scheduled oral arguments for March 23rd. 15 states have grace periods due to delivery delays. Countless voters could be disenfranchised, including overseas Americans, seniors, and the disabled. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
This is KMUN. Up next is a piece from the series Possibly. After that, stay tuned for the Ship Report.
Welcome to Possibly, where we take on huge problems like the future of our planet and break them down into small questions with unexpected answers. I'm Megan Hall. Every fall, as boating season ends, thousands of marinas in New England get busy wrapping up their boats for winter, literally wrapping them in shiny sheets of plastic. We wondered, what's the most environmentally friendly way to protect a boat when the season's over? We had Tamim Zadat and Nat Hardy from our Possibly team look into this.
Hi, Megan.
Hello.
So I often see boats covered in this white plastic stuff during the off season. What is it, actually?
It's just shrink wrap. But to find out how you cover a boat in this plastic, we talked to John Myers. He races a 23-foot sailboat.
I used to shrink wrap my boat when I first got it. They would put a frame on top of the boat, a wooden frame on top of the boat, and it would create kind of a tent over which they could put these sheets of plastic. But then they would apply heat guns to shrink the plastic, and it would hug the frame and the boat.
Shrink wrap works well, but each cover can only be used once. When spring comes, the plastic gets peeled off and tossed out. Some yards, like John's, require sailors to recycle it, but he says that it's not always easy.
You're responsible for removing it yourself unless you pay them more to remove the shrink wrap.
Recycling this plastic is expensive and difficult, so many boatyards and sailors don't bother with the process. That means a lot of that shrink wrap ends up in landfills.
And it's hard to find data on what happens to used boat shrink wrap specifically, but it's made of a type of plastic that's hard to recycle. Even if it gets collected by a recycling program, it's still likely to end up in a landfill.
That's because there isn't much of a market to buy the used plastic.
How much plastic do people use when they wrap these boats?
It varies, but it can take about 15 pounds of plastic to wrap an average-sized boat.
Just here in Rhode Island, there are around 32,000 licensed boats. That adds up to nearly 500,000 pounds of plastic waste every year. More than the weight of the Statue of Liberty.
And we're the smallest state in the country.
We are. To be fair, we have a lot of boats, but still. When the boat wrap ends up in landfills, it not only takes up a lot of space, but it also breaks into microplastics and can release harmful chemicals into the environment.
That doesn't sound good. Do boat owners have any other options?
Yes. For the past few years, John hasn't been using shrink wrap. Instead, he has a custom polyester cover he can reuse year after year.
It's an investment up front. But I think if you have the money to do it, it's kind of a no-brainer. It would pay for itself after a few seasons.
How much more expensive are these custom covers?
So John bought his cover from a Rhode Island company called Kinder Industries for about $1,800.
To put that price into perspective, he says he used to pay around $500 a year for shrink wrap. So it saved him money.
It's my boat like a glove. And so I'm about to use it for, I think, fifth season. And it's still going strong.
Kinder Industries says that their covers can survive 10 years or more.
And a reusable cover only weighs a few pounds more than shrink wrap for the same boat. So after only a few years, you're reducing your plastic usage as well.
But not everyone can make that switch. John says reusable covers are harder to fit to larger boats, so many people still need to rely on shrink wrap each winter.
Still, he thinks small boat owners should make the switch.
If somebody were to ask me whether to go with the shrink wrap or to invest in a cover, I'd say just start saving for the cover. I mean, as soon as you can do it, do it.
So what's the takeaway here?
Reusable covers can really help boat owners, especially owners of small boats, cut down on their seasonal plastic waste.
And it's one more example of a bigger problem. We often rely on single-use plastics because they're cheaper and more convenient.
But a little investment up front can save money and reduce waste in the long run.
Got it. Thanks to Meme and Nat. That's it for today. You can find more information or ask a question about the ways your choices affect our planet at AskPossibly.org. You can also subscribe to Possibly wherever you get your podcasts or follow us on social media at AskPossibly. Possibly is a co-production of Brown University's Institute for Environment and Society, Brown's Climate Solutions Initiative, and Ocean State Media.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN News team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchin, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.